books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, I'll be chatting to author Isabel Ashdown about the brand new One Girl, One Summer. Plus, we'll find some brand new books entering the RNIB library. All that on today's Read On. One Girl, One Summer is the new high-cap mystery from Isabel Ashdown, in which a stranger comes to town, literally by falling from the skies above. On a peaceful hillside campsite in the heat of summer, a private plane crash lands. Several are killed and many more lives are shattered, including those of the Gale family who owns the site. The audio version of One Girl, One Summer is read by Antonia Beamish.
As Nell contemplated her descent, the wind rose, whipping through her red curls and causing her oversized shirt to flap like a sail. She grew aware of a small aeroplane approaching from out over the water, the distant burr of its engine like the pleasing hum of a lawnmower on a lazy Sunday morning. How ordinary she must appear to the approaching pilot, she thought, high overhead in the cloudless sky. How carefree. Ha! If they only knew the half of it. In a sudden change of direction, the plane swooped away again, veering off along the coast and further out above the shimmering water. Nell wished she were in that small plane. She wished she were anywhere but here. Nearly 19, and still at home, while the best of her friends headed off to uni and the worst of them stuck around, seemingly happy enough to stay in high cap forever, having babies and marrying the boy next door. She checked the time on her phone. It wasn't yet 7 a.m, and other than that circling plane, all was still. The main road below had been empty for at least the past 10 minutes, but now a vehicle appeared, and, as it turned in through the campsite gates below, she recognised it as her mother's battered orange Citroën. Nell traced its journey along the well-tended path past Goldie and the farm shop and the various communal blocks, until it stopped near the children's playground in a parking bay reserved for staff. At once, Nell remembered she was meant to be at home with Albie for Mum's early cleaning shift, a concession she'd grudgingly agreed to last night before she'd slammed the front door on their argument.
"Just get him to tennis practice at 8,
Mum had called after her with a dismissive flap of her fag hand, one foot inside the kitchen, one out the back door.
"Then you can do whatever you like." "Ha! Anything except go travelling," Nell had yelled back, shrill with rage.
One Girl, One Summer, it opens on a peaceful hilltop campsite in the heat of summer when a private plane crash lands onto a countryside campsite. Several people are killed and many more lives are shattered or destroyed, including those of members of the family called the Gales, who own the campsite and who have a member of their family seriously injured in this plane crash. It's a sort of multi-narrative story, which allows us to sort of see into the points of view of 18-year-old teenager Nell Gale, who is gripped with guilt because her brother is one of the victims and she was meant to be looking after him and had failed to do so on that day. And also her mother, who she has this tense relationship with. And then the third voice, another woman in the story, is D.I. Ali Sampson, who comes in halfway through to launch an investigation both into the air crash, but also into a series of other crimes that have been taking place in this small coastal Dorset town of Highcap.
"Mum?" Nell spoke into the phone, but her voice was muffled beneath the roar. Albie was still balanced at the top of the skate ramp, waiting for his sister, or perhaps transfixed by the spectacle himself. And for long seconds, Nell could not move. Inert, she was gripped by the strongest sensation of drifting high above herself, high above them all, helpless with certainty that another bad thing was about to happen.
Nell?
Mum's voice echoed through the handset. But later, Nell wouldn't be sure whether she'd imagined it, because the next thing she heard was the bone-crunching explosion of metal and glass as the campsite below her disappeared behind a vast cloud of billowing grey dust. Caravans and tents and a child's bright red skateboard toppled, toy-like, across the green coastal plain, and Aunt Susie's Land Rover ploughed headlong into the giant golden rabbit.
It shares a bit of DNA with Homecoming, as in it's set in Highcap, and we get a mention of the starlings. But it is a standalone novel. You can read it without having read Homecoming.
That's right. So I haven't so far, this is my 10th novel, but I haven't so far written any sort of series of books. But this one, it shares the universe of Highcap, I suppose. It's also set in a contemporary time. Highcap is an imagined blend of places that I know on the West Dorset coast. It's sort of Lyme Regis and Bridport, it's countryside and it's coast. I very much fell in love with the area many years ago and have now made it my home. And Highcap to me represents, you know, all the things that are wonderful about that Dorset coast, but it also gives me the opportunity to explore those wonderful smaller communities where big things happen. You know, big things happen to people, don't they? Small things on a global scale are actually enormous in small communities and within families. So within this story, it's very much the same location. We share one character, which is the detective, although it's not truly a police procedural type of detective story. This character comes back in, and I quite enjoyed bringing her back in and just developing her with a light touch as she helps to bring forward the characters that are so important in One Girl, One Summer.
Yeah, it seems like you've taken a family, albeit a dysfunctional family, but what family isn't, and sort of thrown a grenade in the form of a plane and amongst them all.
Yes, you know, I also teach creative writing, and so I have huge fascination about the aspects of storytelling and, you know, what makes story work and what are the themes of a story. And I think it was the novelist John Gardner once said there are only two types of story. There's the character goes on an adventure or a stranger comes to town. And so with this particular book, at the very opening, I figured, well, what if that stranger just drops from the sky? You know, what bigger kind of arrival could there be? And so, of course, we have this pilot dropping from the sky, and he becomes known as the unknown pilot, as the world tries to work out who he is and where he came from.
It's narrated by Antonia Beamish. Was there a discussion at the start about using two narrators?
Yes, all of my books have gone to audio, and I'm very fortunate with my publisher, Orion, that at the early stages, I'm always sent a fairly decent shortlist that they have selected. And it varies from book to book because, of course, we've got three voices, three, you know, narrative strands here. So we could have chosen three narrators. We could have chosen two. In this case, the guys in the audio team came to me and said, actually, we think that one narrator would work equally well for these three characters. And Antonia Beamish was one of the shortlist. And, you know, listening to some samples, I felt that she could do a really good job of those three different voices. You know, I've had all sorts of narrators in the past. I've had Imogen Church, Sarah Novak, Emily Joyce, you know, all wonderful narrators. And it's quite a tough job deciding, you know, who would really represent it well. But I think she's done a great job.
Do you never fancy narrating one of your own books yourself?
No, well, I love reading extracts of my book, you know, when I do a book event in a bookstore or on a podcast or on a recording. But actually, I like to limit myself to about 5 minutes. So You know, I think it takes a very particular skill. You know, many of these voice actors are actors, you know, in person too. And whilst I know the beats of my book, I think those voice actors really, really put some life into it. And they've got that distance, I think, which is really useful. I'm rather wedded to every word that I've written, and they're seeing it for the first time. And I think, you know, all hats, all credit to them. I couldn't do it.
Do you listen to a lot of audiobooks yourself?
I do. You know, I'm a voracious reader, and but I don't have enough hours in the day. I'd love to be able to sit and read, you know, for hours on end, but I have to write, I have to do other, you know, and do other work. So, you know, a few years ago, I started listening to Audible books, and then discovered that libraries were offering a selection of audiobooks too. And so I usually get through at least one a week while I'm washing up or cooking or doing housework or other things. So they have formed a really important backdrop to my consumption of stories. Just as actually, you know, watching television programs like, you know, and movies and listening to radio dramas, I believe all story is story, because you do still get some people who are a little bit sniffy about listening to stories rather than reading, you know, reading the text. But I'm a huge fan. I can't get enough of audiobooks, to be honest.
And one thing I noticed, I maybe got an early version of it, but did the name of One Girl, One Summer change at some point?
It did. So this was one of those things that happens in publishing. So we were sort of, you know, hurtling towards the point at which we would share the cover. You know, the cover reveal for an author is always a nice moment where you can kind of share what your book looks like, what the name of the book is. And right before, in fact, I think on the day that I was going to be sharing those things, I got a phone call from my publisher saying, we need to talk about the name. And this is one of those examples where the sales team, rather than the creative, you know, rather than the creative or editorial team, the sales team have an influence on what your book, the final package is. So I think there were two things at work there. One was the sales team felt like Weathering, which was the name, wasn't as good as it could be for this particular type of book. And the other thing was, I had noticed actually, very shortly before my book, another book came out with the same name, Weathering. Different genre, but it sort of felt like it was wrong. So we had to pivot very quickly and go through our short list of names and sort of wrestle ourselves into a position where we were all happy with One Girl, One Summer, which I love actually now, because it really has a sort of, it almost has a sense of place just in those four words. We changed the cover too, so everything ground to a halt, and the book went out. It launched on time, but it was all crunched up at the end. But these things happen in publishing.
Yeah, it wasn't until the plane crashed that I was sure I was using the right book. You mentioned the cover. One thing we'll miss, actually, if we download the book from RNIB Tone Books, is the cover. Could you give us a little description of it?
Yes, so the description of the cover is, we have a sort of sunset evening sky with a woman standing at the end of one of those wooden walkways that you'd walk across to reach the beach on certain stretches of men, in fact, across the world, these sort of wooden walkways that lead you down to the sand. There's a gentle breeze in the air and the reeds are kind of blowing, and the girl is looking out towards the sunset. So it's a lone figure, very much representing the main character, this 18-year-old Nell, who should be on the brink of the summer of her life, having finished A-levels and with all the adventures ahead of her. But this plane comes down, and an event that we don't understand until later in the book has also occurred to Nell the night before. And it becomes an event that she now cannot speak of, because the effects of this plane crash and the effects on her family and on her brother are too great for her to be able to deal with the trauma that she herself is hiding.
With rigid fingers, she fumbled to get a grip on her phone and dialed 999. This, Nell would recognise later, would be her flashbulb moment, the memory she would recall forevermore, a vivid technicolour showreel of where she was when it happened, in the seconds that separated the before from the after. "Ambulance!" she cried when the operator connected at the other end. "There's been a plane crash at the Golden Rabbit Holiday Park on the Port Regis Tamir Road at the foot of Highcap Hill. I'm there now. I'm on the hill. I can see everything."
We'll have more from Isabel Ashdown in a moment, but for now, let's head to the RNIB Talking Books Library to hear about some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. For those who love history, we have Catherine de Medici by Mary Hollingsworth, which was given to us by Bloomsbury.
The Legend of Catherine de Medici, 1519 to 1589, as an evil, vicious and corrupt queen, has proved one of the most durable myths in history. It has its roots in one of the bloodiest events of the 16th century, the brutal massacre of thousands of Protestants in Paris on St. Bartholomew's Day, the 24th of August, 1572. For Protestants, it was her hands that were red with the blood of these innocent men, women and children, an accusation all the more compelling after Pope Gregory XIII warmly congratulated her on what he saw as a stupendous Catholic victory. So stupendous, in fact, that he had scenes of the triumph painted on the walls of the reception hall in the Vatican. But his enthusiasm was short-lived. She was soon a figure of hate for him and for most Catholics after it became clear that she had no intention of embarking on a campaign to eliminate the rest of the kingdom's Protestant heretics.
Catherine de Medici lived her life at the storm centre of European and French politics in an age of religious conflict. Born to Lorenzo II, the Medici ruler of Florence, and married to a French prince by papal connivance at the age of 14, Catherine was successively Queen Consort of France and mother to three French kings who reigned in an era of almost continuous civil and religious strife. A spendthrift promoter of the arts, Catherine patronised poets, painters and sculptors, lavished ruinous sums of the building and embellishment of monuments and palaces, and masterminded spectacular entertainments and tournaments that prefigured the splendour and ritual of the court of Versailles. She is remembered as the epitome of the scheming royal matriarch. Legend has it that Catherine maintained 80 ladies-in-waiting at court, whom she used as bait to seduce courtiers for political ends, while her admiration for the reputed seer Nostradamus fueled claims of an interest in the occult and the dark arts. Perhaps the most powerful woman in 16th century Europe, and certainly the most extraordinary and influential.
Her reputation for evil mushroomed among Catholics and Protestants alike, far beyond the issue of the massacre. For many at the time, she was a witch, steeped in the arts of poison, sorcery, and other malicious practices she had brought to France from her Florentine homeland. Others accused her of using the duplicity and deviousness applauded by her compatriot Niccolò Machiavelli to foment the civil wars that ravaged France during the second half of the 16th century and threatened the kingdom's survival. She was despised for her ignoble ancestry. She was blamed for debasing the French language with her Italianisms. And the legend of this maggot from the tomb of Italy was taken up with gusto by writers from Alexandre Dumas, whose La Reine Margot, 1845, painted a lurid picture of Catherine as a greedy, power-crazed mother surrounded by her debauched court, to Jean Plaidy and her 1960s trilogy Madame Serpent, the Italian Woman, and Queen Jezebel. The power of this myth has made Catherine's own achievements all but invisible. Her story may be less colourful, but it is fascinating nonetheless. The daughter of Lorenzo de Medici, parvenu Duke of Florence, and Madeleine de la Tour d'Auvergne, a French royal princess, she was orphaned within a month of her birth when her mother died of puerperal fever and her father of syphilis. Her unfortunate start, combined with the storms and uncertainties of 16th century European politics, guided her trajectory from orphan to queen, and then to widow when her husband Henry II was killed in 1559 in a jousting accident.
Catherine de Medici, The Life and Times of the Serpent Queen by Mary Hollingsworth is read by Rachel Bavage and runs for 15 hours and 24 minutes.
Carbolics by James May was given to us by Hodder.
There's a good chance you're listening to this on a smartphone or something like an iPad. How fantastic is that? Forgive me for still being amazed by this sort of thing, but it is completely mind-blowing. I recently worked out that there's more processing power in my pocket today than there was in the whole country when I was born. The internet. It's the greatest single advancement that humankind has enjoyed in my lifetime. The world's people and their thoughts are all within arm's reach, always, and it's perfectly accessible. A smartphone isn't bag of chips cheap, granted, but when its price is measured against what it can do for you, nothing comes even remotely close, not even chips. And these things are improving so quickly that your new one is outdated by the time you've finished unboxing it. It is the greatest triumph that manufacturing science has yet given us.
Top Gear and Grand Tour legend James May's quirky, entertaining take on cars, trucks and even the bicycle. Why does a man with a Ferrari and a Porsche drive a Fiat Panda? Is going fast really necessary? Is it your fault if you get run over? Why will electric cars really save the planet? Possibly. In Carbolics, the UK's favourite petrol head, after Clarkson and Hammond, James May answers these questions and many more. Across 80 essays, James gives his quirky, entertaining take on cars, motorbikes and trucks and explains why the bicycle might just be the best invention of all.
But not far behind, I'd like to suggest, is the 600cc sports motorcycle. Sports bikes have become unfashionable, usurped by adventure bikes and super scooters, but I don't think we should write them off just yet. The 600cc sports bike is, to my mind, the perfect consumer good, because everything about it, price, size, weight, performance, appearance, proportion, sound, usability, capacity, chassis technology, resolves at a sort of nodal point of motorcycle desirability that makes me fizz so fearsomely I'm consumed by a baboon-like urge to mount it and be off. The gods will it. Mine's a Honda CBR600RR, but that's a detail. Any offering from the Japanese Big Four or Triumph or the Italians will do, and as long as it was built in the last decade, because these things haven't advanced that much owing to the decline in sales. They may disappear entirely soon, the CBR certainly will, because Honda can't see the point in spending the cash to upgrade the engine to meet Euro 4 emissions laws. But no matter, I've already got mine, and if I could get it up the stairs, I'd keep it next to my side of the bed.
Carbolics, a personal motoring disinfectant by James May, is read by the author and runs for 3 hours and 45 minutes.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And we'll have more from author Isabel Ashdown after this.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen. And I've been reading for R&IB Talking Books, although I don't like to remind myself, for about 20 years. I think my first book was Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. And I remember that that was a bit of a lesson for me, as I had to learn to sit still and be very careful about my enunciation. One of my favorite books over all those years, because we laugh so much, was Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor. It reminded me of my old radio days, although maybe they weren't as funny as Garrison Keillor's radio days. Back in Toronto, when I was a child, I had a program, and it was on Saturday mornings, but also then I did drama with young children on Saturday mornings with fairy stories. It was called Doorway to Fairyland. So it reminded me of all that, the good old times in CBC Radio in Toronto, but also because Garrison Keillor is very funny, it was a joy to read.
Studio B was the snakebite studio at WLT, the tomb of the radio mummy, and bad things happened to people who went in there. It was a big triangular room on the second floor of the Hotel Ogden, where WLT was located, at 12th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis. Dad Benson said it felt like a vacuum chamber. Once, he gasped for breath during Friendly Neighbor, and two huge flies dove into his throat and almost choked him. The Reverend Irving James Knox claimed he couldn't hear himself talk in there when he did Hope for Tomorrow. He was used to sanctuaries where his words rolled off the walls like ocean surf. In Studio B, the waves hit a big sponge. Reed Seymour once got the hiccup so bad in there his partial plate came off and he had to gum the news. And a week later, three of the Shepherd Boys, a gospel quartet, slipped in and quietly de-pantsed him during a long account of a tragic house fire, leaving six persons dead in St. Paul. He kept reading, but he yipped twice when they pulled off his shorts. Every other day or so, the shepherds snuck in during the noontime news to play their little tricks. They put spit in his water glass and pelted him with food and poured mucilage in his shoes, and one day they lit the script on fire and he had to read very fast. It was an obituary, and he never got to the survived by part. So the next day, Reed locked the studio door. Then, after the newscast was safely delivered, the door wouldn't unlock. That was the sort of thing that happened in Studio B.
I love reading here because, first of all, it's a very friendly atmosphere, and the studios are good, and the books are generally worthy. Now, I hope to continue reading for another 20 years. I hope you, as well as I, enjoy the talking books that are done here at the RNIB, and thanks for listening to them.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now let's return to Isabel Ashdown. One Girl, One Summer is her 10th novel, but it all started with the book Glasshopper, available from RNIB Talking Books and commercially as read by Joe Jameson. Let's have a listen.
I love November. I love the frosty grass that pokes up between the paving slabs and the smoke that puffs out of your nostrils like dragon's breath. I love the ready-made ice rink that freezes underneath the broken guttering in the school playground. And I love the salt and vinegar heat inside a noisy pub, when everyone outside is walking about under hats and gloves with dripping red noses. This one Saturday afternoon, Dad and me are down the Royal Oak, getting ready to watch the match. Dad tells Eric the landlord that I'm 14, so I can come into the bar, so long as I only have Coke. Not that I'd want what they all drink. Dad shouts over, "Fancy a bag of nuts, Jakey?" And I give him the thumbs up from the corner seat we've bagged. It's great today, because it's just me and Dad. Andy's on some boring scout trip, and he won't be back till tea time. And Matthew, well, he just sort of disappeared a few weeks back. One morning I got out of bed and went into Matt's room to wake him up with this fart I'd got brewing. It kills him every time. Anyway, this one morning I go into his room and he's not there. His bed was empty, so were his drawers. He'd taken all his clothes and records, so I knew he wasn't planning on coming back any time soon. Even his aftershave had gone. When I went in to tell Mum, she said, "He'll be back when he's hungry." And she rolled over and went back to sleep. But he didn't come back.
Joe Jameson reading from Glasshopper by my guest Isabel Ashdown. Now, I believe it was an extract of that book which won a prize and kick-started your writing career.
It was. So I had a career before I was a writer. I worked for The Body Shop for many years. And when I had young children in my kind of early to mid-30s, they were starting to be ready for school. And, you know, the juggling of the big job that I had in The Body Shop was getting tricky. And I had always had this secret desire to write, not one that I'd ever spoken to anyone of, because how ridiculous that I should write a novel. I went to university and did as a mature student, and did a creative writing degree. And whilst I was there, I had some amazing tutors who were very keen on their students putting their work forward for competitions and publications. The idea being that if you're really serious about getting your novel published, you should build up a track record. And so I had been sending out work for a good year, started my novel. I was probably three quarters of the way through writing it. And one of the large newspapers had, I just happened to pick it up because I was waiting for my kids who were swimming. And I was flicking through and I saw this advert for an extract from your unpublished novel. I thought, OK, that looks like an interesting thing. I'll send it in. And I did. I sent in an extract of that novel, Glasshopper. And a whole year later, the phone rang. After I had received lots of rejections for other things, a couple of small wins, but the phone rang and I was told that Faye Weldon and Sir John Mortimer had chosen my extract as the winner of this particular national writing competition. And with that, I was then able to start sending out my manuscript and, you know, citing that as a win. And I very quickly got a couple of agents offering to represent me on the back of that win. So it really was a life-changing moment, winning that competition.
And not only do you have 10 books bound, you know, you're a mentor for the Royal Literary Fund. Tell us about the RLF.
The RLF are a wonderful charitable organisation, and you know, they really exist in the support of writers. They've been around for a very long time and they are sustained by some very large gifts left in wills. One of them being A.A. Milne. So, you know, we always raise a glass to Winnie the Pooh whenever we're working with the RLF. The areas that I've worked in, first of all, I was a fellow in a university. So they place an author in a university and you make yourself available to students. You're not teaching them to write, but what you're doing is encouraging students to come to you with their essays and helping them to work through and to effectively become better writers, which is really rewarding because so many students have got great passion and knowledge in their given area. But perhaps, you know, their writing skills, their putting together an elegant essay, for example, needs some help. And we can do that. So that was my starting point. I then became a mentor to other authors going in and doing that. And then I got involved with their Reading Round project, which is where an author will set up a group in a community and you'll have perhaps 10 to 12 people in that group. Each week, those members come along, no homework, no pre-reading, and the author reads to them a poem and a short story, and then the group discusses it, you know, sort of having not had any experience of that story or poem before. It's just the most marvellous arrangement because it's not like a book club. And it opens up whole new worlds to readers and to people who perhaps haven't really been readers before. And so now, having done that for some time, I'm also a mentor for the next group of people going in and setting that up. I'm such a huge fan of the RLF and, you know, they've made a big difference in my career in encouraging me to keep going because, you know, writing is quite a tough area and publishing is quite tough. So having the RLF in, you know, supporting you and knowing that you've got an organisation like that is a really reassuring thing.
And I know you offer one-on-one tutoring and you run writing classes. If anyone listening, and I'm including myself in this, that half-written thing in a drawer somewhere, what are some tips you would give them?
I think a really important one is just do it, because we all writers, whatever stage we're at, there is a tendency to procrastinate around the actual writing because we're scared. I think a lot of the time we're afraid of committing to it. And when I say just do it, you don't have to be putting hours and hours in every day, but you know, if you allow yourself 20 minutes every day and you put it in your diary and you write solidly and you put your phone away for 20 minutes, you'd be amazed how much progress you can make. Enjoy it. That's another really important thing. You know, don't get too earnest about it. Enjoy the process, enjoy the research, and don't worry too much about the editing until you've got a good word countdown. And do join things like online classes and communities. I run a Facebook group, which is just a group of people who love reading and love writing. And it gives a space for people to start kind of talking about what they're doing, where maybe they don't have that in their family life. They might not want to tell people that they're writing, but they might want to have a community where they can do so. And if anybody wants to find out more about those things, have a look at my website. I've got a Write With Me page that'll lead people to various things like my online courses.
Now, One Girl, One Summer is available in audio. That's opening up to a whole new audience of people who, for whatever reason, dyslexia, injury, don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
It's really important to me. And I think, you know, there is often, in any area of writing, reading, literature, there is the tendency for snobbery to slip in. And I read very widely. I will read great works of literature and I will read the latest, most commercial blockbuster. I think it's really important to not be influenced by those voices that say that's not a good piece of work. You know, read widely and consume stories, because stories are what make us human. You know, I do my work with the Royal Literary Fund, and what I love about that is that I can work with other people and see that enthusiasm growing in others. And and I think audiobooks are just another amazing tool to allow people who, for whatever reason, to listen to audiobook, but also may need to listen to audiobook. And I think it's a real leveler, actually. And actually, a few years ago, one of my books, I think it might have been Flight, I had the RNIB, they had a set up with book clubs, with listening book clubs. And I had a call with a particular group, which was lovely. They were a lovely group of readers. And it was really, I thought it was a really nice and important thing.
Unsteadily, Mum paused for a moment, turning this way and that, before throwing down her cleaning gloves and breaking into a run. Tearing off along the footpath, she sprinted, cutting past the farm shop and its fallen awning, heading with purpose in the direction of the children's playground. For long moments, she disappeared, and Nell watched, breath held.
One Girl, One Summer is available commercially in print as an ebook and in audio as read by Antonia Mish. Anna DeVille, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
This whole business of Talking Books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. And now let's return to the RNIB Talking Books Library to hear about two more brand new books.
Godwin by the award-winning Joseph O'Neill. It was donated by Penguin Random House.
Wolf was behaving strangely with clients and co-workers. Annie, my co-lead, thought we should give him a written warning in accordance with our guidelines. In her opinion, a recent incident crossed the line. I was more cautious. A written warning was a big step. I felt it would be more constructive and less destabilizing to our community to offer Wolf a measure of support. He was a long-standing member of the group. This was the first time that he'd had any real issues with his workplace deportment. I suspected he was having the kind of difficulties that all of us face at one time or another. I told Annie I'd meet him for a coffee and try to find out what was going on.
Mark Wolfe, a brilliant, if self-thwarting, technical writer, lives in Pittsburgh with his wife Sushila and their toddler daughter. His half-brother Jeff, born and raised in the UK, is a desperate young football agent. He pulls Mark across the ocean into a scheme to track down an elusive prospect known only as Godwin, an African teenager Jeff believes could be the next Messi. Narrated in turn by Mark and his work colleague Lakeisha Williams, the novel is both a tale of family and migration, an international adventure story that implicates the brothers in the beauty and ugliness of football, the perils and promises of international business, and the dark history of transatlantic money-making. Joseph O'Neill investigates the legacy of colonialism in the context of family love, global capitalism, and the dreaming individual.
I had no deep feelings about Wolf. I wished him well, of course, but I barely knew him, even though we'd been colleagues for 7 years. Like many of our more experienced members, he worked from home and came to the office only for the occasional meeting. He'd say very little and leave at the first opportunity. That was fine. Members were under no obligation to get involved in the group's internal administration. The group, officially the P4 group, was founded in 2004 as a technical writing cooperative. The cooperators were known as members. Each member paid the group a flat monthly subscription, plus an annual contribution that was calculated as a percentage of their earnings. In return, the group managed members' client relations, including fee negotiation and billing, provided them an office where they could meet colleagues and clients, and gave them a stronger brand presence. It's more professional for a technical writer to be identified as a part of an organization with an impressive website. A collective like the group is attractive to someone who wants to stay self-employed, but doesn't want the risk, hassle, and isolation associated with being a sole trader or freelancer. The term freelance sounds good, but most folks find the reality stressful and not at all free.
Godwin by Joseph O'Neill is read by Karen Chilton and Kirby Hayborn and runs for 12 hours and 17 minutes.
Also recently donated by Penguin Random House, we have The Midnight Hour by Eve Chase.
Any danger has surely passed. Cycling into the unfolding Paris morning, Maggie can breathe easily again. She'd been dreading yesterday's anniversary, but here she is on the other side, weirdly fine. Maggie knows, as people who have survived things do, that fine is everything. A quiet triumph. She takes nothing for granted. Not the sun glitter on the Seine, the rhythmic brush of a horse chestnut leaf stuck in her front bicycle wheel, the waft of coffee. Paris. Life. Rising from the saddle, Maggie stands on the pedals and cycles faster, her blouse sleeve swelling with air, the river's truffle tang. Her oversized sunglasses, Le Bon Marché sale, a rare present to herself, slip down her nose and she thumbs them up. The bicycle wobbles.
Notting Hill, London. Lou Parker's famous mother walks out of their pink front door and doesn't return home by midnight, or the midnight after. Looking after her little brother, trying to piece together where their mother might be, Lou ventures into a different world, far from the fancy terraces, filled with ramshackle antique shops, shadowy figures, a place where time seems to have stopped. And Lou must protect her brother at all costs. 21 years later, the new owner of a Notting Hill house starts excavating a basement, oblivious to what might lie beneath. While in a writer's Saint-Germain apartment, a mobile phone rings and the clock starts ticking again. Sweeping from a vibrant London street to the boulevards of Paris, to an old English country house. The Midnight Hour is a story about dark secrets hidden within a golden family and a woman desperately trying to turn back the hands of time before it's too late.
Although capricious with iffy breaks,
Maggie's second-hand Velo is the perfect red of a Parisian lipstick, so she loves it. Bouncing inside its front basket is an unravelling straw tote, flopping open to reveal a baguette, a honking camembert, and a stuffed bag of peaches, perilously perched and seeping in the early summer heat. Reaching to nudge them back in, Maggie's fingertips touch their downy skin, and she starts. Peaches. Something inside Maggie snags, like a chain unexpectedly shifting from one gear to the next. She'd buy her mother peaches at the market, carry them home in a brown paper bag that would disintegrate in the London drizzle. For a vivid moment, she sees her mother holding a peach in her long, elegant fingers, her small smile of anticipation. Thrown by this, how can the past arrive in a bag of peaches? Maggie swerves to the left, just missing an overtaking cyclist. Over his rattle of fast-fire French, her phone rings. Voicemail nips the call. A second later, it goes again. Since Maggie is incapable of leaving a phone unanswered, a neurosis baked into her 2 decades earlier, she breaks abruptly by the bank, where the young and beautiful smoke and loll, and fishes inside her bag. No caller ID. Hello? It's me. You. That voice, husky, London, reaches deep inside, steals the air from her lungs. Hey, she manages after a beat, as if they'd last spoken a week ago, not years before.
The Midnight Hour by Eve Chase is read by Genevieve Gaunt and Bert Seymour and runs for 9 hours 39 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Isabel Ashdown for The Books of Her Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I have so many, and I was very fortunate as a child that my father in particular was a huge reader, and so we were always gifted books for birthdays and Christmas. And a particular one that always stayed with me is Alice in Wonderland, which is, of course, an all-time favourite. I loved the adventure in it, I loved the ridiculousness of it, and I loved the character of Alice. So much so that I named my first child Alice.
What a curious feeling, said Alice. I must be shutting up like a telescope. And so it was indeed. She was now only 10 inches high, and her face brightened up at the thought that she was now the right size for going through the little door into that lovely garden. First, however, she waited for a few minutes to see if she was going to shrink any further. She felt a little nervous about this. For it might end, you know, said Alice, in my going out altogether like a candle. I wonder what I should be like then. And she tried to fancy what the flame of a candle is like after it's blown out, for she couldn't remember ever having seen such a thing. After a while, finding that nothing more happened, she decided on going into the garden at once. But alas for poor Alice, when she got to the door, she found she had forgotten the little golden key. And when she went back to the table for it, she found she could not possibly reach it. She could see it quite plainly through the glass, and she tried her best to climb up one of the table legs, but it was too slippery. And when she had tired herself out with trying, the poor little thing sat down and cried. "Come, there's no use in crying like that," said Alice to herself rather sharply. "I advise you to leave off this minute." She generally gave herself very good advice, though she very seldom followed it, and sometimes she scolded herself so severely as to bring tears into her eyes. And once she remembered trying to box her own ears for having cheated herself in a game of croquet she was playing against herself. For this curious child was very fond of pretending to be two people. But it's no use now, thought poor Alice, to pretend to be two people. Why, there's hardly enough of me left to make one respectable person. Soon her eye fell on a little glass box that was lying under the table. She opened it and found in it a very small cake on which the words, "Eat me," were beautifully marked in currants. "Well, I'll eat it," said Alice. "And if it makes me larger, I can reach the key. And if it makes me smaller, I can creep under the door, so either way I'll get into the garden, and I don't care which happens." She ate a little bit and said anxiously to herself, "Which way? Which way?" holding her hand on the top of her head to feel which way it was growing. And she was quite surprised to find that she remained the same size. To be sure, this generally happens when one eats cakes, but Alice had got so much into the way of expecting nothing but out-of-the-way things to happen that it seemed quite dull and stupid for life to go on in the common way. So she set to work and very soon finished off the cake.
That's Robin Holmes reading from Alice in Wonderland, available from RNIB Talking Books, as is Alice Through the Looking Glass. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily cuddle up with and reread?
I love I Captured the Castle. It's just one of those books which is, I always find it very difficult to describe I Captured the Castle by Dodie Smith. It's just got a wonderful world building, and the characters and the voices are so comforting. I think you'd probably find that on many a reader's list.
I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left, and I have found that sitting in a place where you've never sat before can be inspiring. I wrote my very best poem while sitting on the hen house, though even that isn't a very good poem. I've decided my poetry is so bad that I mustn't write any more of it. Drips from the roof are plopping into the water butt by the back door. The view through the windows above the sink is excessively drear. Beyond the dank garden in the courtyard are the ruined walls on the edge of the moat. Beyond the moat, the boggy ploughed fields stretch to the leaden sky. I tell myself that all the rain we've had lately is good for nature, and that at any moment spring will surge on us. I try to see leaves on the trees and the courtyard filled with sunlight. Unfortunately, the more my mind's eye sees green and gold, the more drained of all colour does the twilight seem. It is comforting to look away from the windows and towards the kitchen fire, near which my sister Rose is ironing, though she obviously can't see properly, and it will be a pity if she scorches her only nightgown. I have two, but one is minus its behind. Rose looks particularly fetching by firelight because she is a pinkish person. Her skin has a pink glow, and her hair is pinkish gold, very light and feathery. Although I am rather used to her, I know she is a beauty. She's nearly 21 and very bitter with life. I am 17, look younger, feel older. I am no beauty, but have a neatish face. I've just remarked to Rose that our situation is really rather romantic. Two girls in this strange and lonely house. She replied that she saw nothing romantic about being shut up in a crumbling ruin surrounded by a sea of mud. I must admit that our home is an unreasonable place to live in. Yet I love it.
I Captured the Castle by Dodie Smith is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Candida Gubbins. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
One of the best books that I've read in the past year is Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus, which is an incredible debut. It's been out for a little while, and I think I was put off reading it because it had so much press around it. Sometimes I find that delays my appetite for reading something. And I thought it was going to be lighter than it actually is. I like a book with many, many layers and lots of interesting themes. And in this particular book, we follow the path of a particular woman at a particular time and the struggles that she has as a woman interested in science. And it's just wonderful. It covers so many really important themes, and I'd recommend it to everyone.
Back in 1961, when women wore shirtwaist dresses and joined garden clubs and drove legions of children around in seatbeltless cars without giving it a second thought, back before anyone knew there'd even be a 60s movement, much less one that its participants would spend the next 60 years chronicling, back when the big wars were over and the secret wars had just begun and people were starting to think fresh and believe everything was possible, the 30-year-old mother of Madeline Zott rose before dawn every morning and felt certain of just one thing. Her life was over. Despite that certainty, she made her way to the lab to pack her daughter's lunch. "Fuel for learning," Elizabeth Zott wrote on a small slip of paper before tucking it into her daughter's lunchbox. Then she paused, her pencil in midair as if reconsidering. "Play sports at recess, but do not automatically let the boys win," she wrote on another slip. Then she paused again, tapping her pencil against the table. "It is not your imagination," she wrote on a third. "Most people are awful." She placed the last two on top.
Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Marlanda Reason. And once again, Isabel Ashton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, you can always find another episode of Read On as a podcast. Well, over 350 episodes on your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read on Spotify, Google, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email the show using radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on Twitter @talking_books.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.